gold, the Bitcoin hold.com. The Bitcoin self-custody is the whole. Find the strength inside your soul. Your soul. Oh, the Bitcoin hold.com.
Imagine, like, you spend years constructing this state-of-the-art bank vault. We are talking foot-thick titanium, biometric scanners, thermal laser grids, the works.
Right.
It's mathematically impenetrable.
Yeah.
And then, you know, one Tuesday afternoon, the attacker doesn't even bother trying to break the door down.
They don't need to.
No. Instead, they just call your cell phone, create this completely fabricated emergency about your account being compromised, and they convince you to literally walk down to the vault, open it up,
and you just hand over the gold yourself.
Exactly. You just give it to them.
It is, it's the ultimate bypass. I mean, why spend centuries trying to crack the cryptography when you can just hack the human holding the keys in a matter of minutes?
Welcome to this week's episode of the Bitcoin Hole. Today, we're doing a deep dive into this massive collision happening right now across the Bitcoin ecosystem.
And it really is a collision.
Oh, absolutely. On one side, we have the escalating sophistication of these human-targeted social engineering attacks. And on the other side, we have this wave of sovereign hardware updates stepping in to, well, essentially protect us from ourselves.
Yeah, and right in the middle of all this friction, we have this sudden introduction of AI agents into Bitcoin wallets, which is just wild.
It's a lot to process, for sure. But our mission today is to make sense of this pivot toward first principles engineering and what it means for you, the listener, securing your own stack.
Because the tools released this week show that the industry is recognizing a pretty harsh reality. Self-custody isn't just passive storage anymore. It's a serious, active craft.
Right.
We are moving away from assuming users will just have perfect discipline, and we're moving toward enforcing that discipline cryptographically and physically.
So let's start with the human brain. Because the psychology of theft is currently the absolute weakest link in the entire security model. Cryptographic keys are rarely brute forced anymore.
No, almost never.
Right, it's the human mind getting brute forced.
I mean,
the FBI recently reported that crypto investment fraud accounted for nearly $10 billion in cybercrime losses in a single year.
$10
billion. $10 billion. It's staggering. And this week, Casa released a major update specifically targeting this human element. I really want to unpack the mechanics of this because Casa is going directly after what they call the urgency loop.
Okay, so the urgency loop is really the physiological core of social engineering. Attackers, they don't want you to think. They want you to panic.
Just react.
Exactly. So they get you on the phone and they usually come armed with like your name, your cellular provider, maybe even your account balances from some exchange data breach.
Which makes it feel so real.
Right. And they create this high pressure scenario, usually claiming your funds are actively being stolen in that exact moment. And it triggers an amygdala hijack.
Right. Your brain just goes into fight or flight.
Yeah. They force you to move funds before your prefrontal cortex, the logical part of your brain, actually has time to evaluate the situation critically.
Well, I saw Casa's standout new feature is this phone call detection thing. And the way it works is honestly fascinating.
It's very clever.
It really is. The app basically detects if you are on an active phone call when you try to send funds. And it doesn't listen to the audio or check caller ID or anything.
Because that would be a privacy nightmare.
A total nightmare, yeah. It just detects the call state from the operating system itself.
Yeah.
If you're on the phone, the app completely freezes the transaction and demands an advisor verification code.
Which is brilliant because that feature specifically breaks the momentum of the attack.
Right.
Because if the person screaming in your ear claims to be from Casa support, and then the app asks for an advisor code, and the person on the phone doesn't have it,
the illusion shatters.
Instantly. Yeah. You realize they're a scammer, the panic subsides, and that urgency loop is just broken.
They also introduced Guardian mode, which takes this concept even further.
Yeah.
Like, if you opt in, every single transaction requires a live video verification call with two Casa advisors, followed by a mandatory 48-hour hold.
The 48-hour hold is really the most critical component there.
You think so? Over the video call?
Oh, definitely. Because psychologically, human beings just cannot sustain a state of pure panic for two full days.
That makes sense. You just burn out.
Exactly. By enforcing time delays, we artificially introduce physical time constraints to neutralize digital urgency. You sleep on it, you talk to your spouse, you realize you're being played.
They also added whitelisting, which puts a 48-hour delay on any new withdrawal address, and suspicious account activity tracking, which they track your logins at the city level to alert you to impossible travel like logging in from Montreal and then Tokyo 20 minutes later.
Right.
But they managed to do it without storing your actual IP address, which preserves your privacy.
Which is key. But, you know, taking a step back, this vulnerability to social engineering extends far beyond just moving funds. It plagues the entire, the broader two-factor authentication ecosystem.
Oh, the 2FA stuff is a mess right now.
It really is. We're seeing attackers buy automated OTP one-time password bot attacks on Telegram for as little as $10.
Wait, $10?
$10. It literally costs $10 to fully automate an account takeover.
That is terrifying. I mean, we all know by now that relying on SMS or email codes is essentially asking to be robbed, because cellular networks are unencrypted and highly vulnerable to SIM swapping.
Yeah, SIM swapping is rampant.
But these bots are increasingly bypassing standard authenticator apps on your phone, too, right?
Yeah, that happens because if your mobile device itself is compromised by malware, well, the authenticator app is compromised right along with it.
It's all in the same sandbox.
Exactly. That's why the standard is moving heavily toward hardware-based 2FA. So TOTP, which uses those time-based codes expiring every 30 to 60 seconds, that's a step up.
Right, like Google Authenticator, but on a device.
Right. But HOTP, which uses HMAC-based, counter-driven codes on dedicated hardware tokens, that's far superior. Tools like Blossom and Jade Plus are moving 2FA strictly to offline hardware.
So your second factor is literally a physical secret.
Exactly. It's locked behind a PennUn on a physical device that simply doesn't connect to the internet.
So if we can't trust our own panic brains when a scammer calls, we have to offload that discipline to something physical.
Mm.
The hardware literally has to step in and act like a strict parent.
That's a good way to put it.
And this week, we saw firmware updates that essentially force this operational discipline on the user.
Yeah. Look at the new FrostSnap release, version 0.3.0. They have totally revamped the user experience to force you into good habits.
Right.
And importantly, they provide deterministic builds for this firmware.
Okay, let's pause there for a second. Explain deterministic builds for the listener.
Sure. A deterministic build means that anyone can compile the open source code themselves and mathematically prove it matches the exact software FrostSnap is distributing. Like the hash for this one is 6273DC and so on.
So no hidden backdoors.
Right. It guarantees the supply chain hasn't been compromised and that your strict parent hasn't been quietly bribed by an attacker.
I love that. And FrostSnap also introduced this on-device backup check that is literally a mandatory multiple-choice quiz on the device screen.
It's so necessary.
It tests you. You have to prove that you actually rate your backup down correctly before it lets you proceed. Because historically, people would just, you know, scribble 24 words on a piece of paper, misspell three of them, shove it in a desk drawer, and lose their entire net worth 5 years later.
Oh, it happens constantly. Now the hardware is literally testing your competence.
Which is wild. But great.
They also redesigned their verify address dialog. It now features this blurred tap to reveal address.
Oh, so you can't just passively glance at it.
Exactly. You can't just skim the screen and blindly hit confirm. It forces you to actively engage with the device to check the destination address.
That's smart.
And they tweak the backup reminders too. Now, the unfinished backups banner turns bright red the exact moment funds actually land in the wallet.
So it stays quiet when it's empty.
Yeah. But second real value is at risk. It demands your attention.
Wait, hold on, though. Here's where I want to push back a little.
Yeah.
We constantly talk about mass adoption and making Bitcoin easier to use for the average person.
Sure.
But now I have to pass a pop quiz, tap a blurred screen, and wait 48 hours just to move my own money. Doesn't this level of friction just push normal people back to centralized custodians where they can just click forgot password if they mess up?
I hear that a lot, but you have to realize that in Bitcoin, friction is a feature, not a bug, of a sovereign system.
A feature?
Yes. Smooth, frictionless user experiences are designed for fiat platforms where a centralized bank can just reverse a mistake or block a fraudulent transfer.
Because they hold the keys.
Right. In a bearer asset system like Bitcoin, an irreversible mistake is catastrophic. When there is no customer service desk to bail you out, friction is your only safety net.
That's a really solid point.
And we see this exact philosophy deeply embedded in the updates from ColdCard and Bitcoin Keeper this week as well.
Yeah, ColdCard just dropped version 5.5.0, supporting both the MK4 and the newer MK5 hardware.
The one with the Gorilla Glass screen.
Right. And their whole operational philosophy centers around the Address Explorer, which forces you to verify and receive addresses entirely offline on that physical screen.
And then Bitcoin Keeper is taking this to the absolute extreme. They now route connections through Tor by default.
Okay, so I understand Tor is great for privacy, obviously, but why make it the mandatory baseline for a wallet?
Because of how extended public keys or XPubs work.
Walk us through that.
Okay, so your XPub is basically the master map of your wallet. It reveals every single address you have ever generated and ever will generate.
All of them.
All of them. So if your wallet queries a standard Bitcoin node over the regular clear text internet just to check your balance, that node sees your XPub.
And it logs your IP address.
Exactly. It links your entire transaction history directly to your home IP address. Your entire net worth is now tied to your physical geographic location.
That is genuinely terrifying when you think about it.
It is. So Tor routing breaks that link by anonymizing your connection. For Bitcoin Keeper, Tor isn't just an advanced privacy feature. It's a fundamental requirement for your physical safety.
Keeper also enforces this 180-day key health check. It actually nudges you every 6 months per signer. So if a key just sits idle in a safe deposit box somewhere, the app forces you to go prove you still have access to it.
Which is vital because a compromised or degraded key rarely announces itself early.
Right. A piece of paper rots or a metal plate gets misplaced during a move.
Or a hardware device suffers bit rot. You usually only find out when you try to move funds years later and the vault just won't open.
Keeper also strictly enforces air-gapped signing. Partially signed Bitcoin transactions, PSBTs, go out via QR code or microSD card, and signed PSBTs come back in. The vault never actually touches the internet.
Right.
So, practically speaking, how does an air gap actually protect you from, say, a hacker?
By completely eliminating the remote execution environment. Look, if your hardware wallet connects via Bluetooth or a USB cable, a piece of sophisticated malware on your laptop could theoretically find an exploit to query the device directly.
It acts as a bridge.
Exactly. But an air-gapped QR code is just optical data. It contains the transaction details and absolutely nothing else. Malware cannot transmit itself through a static image on a screen.
Okay, so we are building these massive moats. We're air-gapping everything, adding all this intentional friction. And then, in the literal same breath this week, the industry started actively inviting AI agents into our wallets.
Yeah, it sounds contradictory.
It sounds insane. How does that make any sense? We are building impenetrable offline fortresses, and then we're basically handing the blueprints to an artificial intelligence.
It comes down to separating logic from authority.
Okay.
AI doesn't understand risk, and it certainly has no skin in the game. If you give an AI direct, unbridled control of your private keys, you are voluntarily compromising your security. Don't do that.
Obviously.
But if you use the AI to manage complex protocols while you retain the ultimate cryptographic authority, you gain the efficiency of machine intelligence without sacrificing the sovereign verification that defines Bitcoin.
Okay, I saw Nunchuk's new CLI and Agent Skills release approaches this through this concept of bounded authority. And I'll be honest, the idea of an AI managing my funds terrifies me, but this implementation is actually brilliant.
Yeah, bounded authority means the AI operates inside a strictly mathematically restricted environment. Nunchuk provided a specific practical example this week involving decaying multi-sig wallets.
This is a perfect example of something a normal person completely struggles with. Like, you might want to build an inheritance plan, so you just tell the AI in plain English, create a wallet that starts as a 3 of 4 multi-sig. After 2 years, if I haven't moved the funds, let it decay to a 2 of 4. And after 5 years, decay it to a 1 of 4, so my heirs only need to find one key.
Right. And the AI takes that natural language prompt and drafts the complex miniscript required to actually make it happen.
Miniscript is tough.
It is. Let's define miniscript briefly for the audience. It is essentially a smart contract programming language specifically for Bitcoin. It allows you to build these complex conditions like time locks and multi-signature decay in a structured, predictable way.
But writing it yourself is a nightmare.
Writing miniscript by hand is highly technical and extremely prone to catastrophic human error. So the AI is perfect for drafting it.
So it's like giving an AI your keys is like giving a teenager the keys to a Ferrari. But bounded authority is like putting a governor on the engine that literally won't let it go over 30 miles per hour.
Right.
And locking the GPS so it can only drive to the grocery store and back. The AI can drive, but physics prevents it from crashing your life.
That is the exact dynamic. The AI drafts the transaction, it manages the coin control, it organizes your UTXO history, but it operates strictly in a hardware security module mode or as a watch-only assistant.
So you still have to physically sign?
Yes. The user retains the final cryptographic say. The AI proposes the decaying multi-sig contract, but your offline hardware devices actually sign it into reality.
We're seeing this sandboxing approach at the hardware level, too.
Yeah.
Foundation Devices has been pushing their Passport Prime, which runs on KeyOS, a fully open-source microkernel, and a community member named Owen literally used an AI this week to code a functional secure notes app for the Passport Prime in a matter of days, despite not even being a developer.
Which is incredible.
The AI handled the coding, but because of KeyOS, the app is deeply, deeply sandboxed.
And UmbrellaOS is solving the AI dilemma in a similar way for home node servers. They have these AI apps, Hermes and OpenClaw, running natively. To prevent the agents from doing unpredictable things, UmbrellaOS started injecting runtime context directly into the agent's prompt behind the scenes.
Wait. How does injecting context actually limit the AI?
So the system injects hidden data into the prompt telling the agent, you are running inside an UmbrellaOS app sandbox. You are only allowed to store data in this specific directory. You do not have permission to self-update. You absolutely cannot access the node's private keys.
Oh, I see.
It explicitly maps out the sandbox walls so the AI understands its operational limits before it even processes your request.
So at the interface layer, we are battling social engineers, we are submitting to these strict hardware coaches, and we're wrestling with sandboxing AI agents. But beneath all of this drama, the base layer of Bitcoin doesn't care.
No, it doesn't care at all.
It just cares about math and block space. And right. Sparrow Wallet's version 2.5.2 release this week is a perfect example of focusing on those base layer fundamentals.
Yeah, Sparrow strengthened their verification of loaded PSBTs. The wallet now explicitly warns you if a transaction has non-default sihash types or unknown script types.
Explain sihash types for us.
Sure. A sihash type essentially dictates which specific parts of a transaction your signature is actually signing off on. If an attacker somehow manipulates the sihash, they could potentially alter the destination of the funds after you sign.
Wow.
Yeah, so Sparrow is catching these weird edge case manipulations before you commit cryptographic suicide.
But the biggest update in Sparrow, I think, is their implementation of dust detection for silent payment wallets.
Yeah.
They set the default limit to 5,000 sats to prevent dust attacks.
Very important update.
So if you're holding Bitcoin, why do you need to worry about dust accumulating in your wallet? I always think of a dust attack like, imagine someone throwing thousands of pennies all over your front lawn.
Okay, I like this analogy.
Right. Like the pennies are technically money, sure, but the only reason they threw them there is so they can hide in the bushes and watch exactly how you walk around your yard when you try to pick them all up.
Exactly.
They are tracking your movements.
That is the exact mechanism of blockchain surveillance. A dust attack involves sending tiny, almost economically worthless amounts of Bitcoin, the dust, to a massive number of addresses.
Just spraying it everywhere.
Right. And the attacker's goal is to de-anonymize you. When you eventually go to spend your funds, your wallet software might automatically combine that tiny dust UTXO unspent transaction output with your larger, highly private UTXOs.
Just to make change.
Exactly. And the moment those inputs are mixed together in a single transaction, the attacker surveillance software permanently links all those addresses together.
Your privacy is shattered for the cost of a few pennies.
It's brutal. And beyond the privacy loss, there is a dangerous technical trade-off known as the UTXO fee trap.
Oh, this catches so many people.
It really does. Because a transaction that moves a tiny amount of value does not mean it incurs a tiny network fee. Network fees are based on the data size of the transaction in the block space, not the monetary value being transferred.
Right.
So if you accumulate hundreds of these dust UTXOs, consolidating them later requires a massive transaction data size. In a high-fee environment, the cost to move the dust could be exponentially higher than the dust itself is actually worth.
Which is exactly why Sparrow, setting a 5,000 Satoshi limit for incoming silent payments, is so important. Silent payments are great because they give you a reusable address without linking your transactions on-chain, but that obviously makes them a massive target for dust.
Huge target.
So if a transaction is under 5,000 sats, Sparrow basically flags it and says, yeah, we aren't automatically accepting this. It's probably a tracking attempt.
It protects both your privacy and your future fee budget. Now, contrast that 5,000 sat limit with Liana Wallet. Liana actually just lowered their dust limit to 500 sats in their version 14 update.
Wait, If dust is a surveillance risk and a massive fee trap, why on earth would Liana lower their limit and let more dust in?
Because Liana is built specifically for those complex Miniscript inheritance paths we discussed earlier.
Oh, right.
Users were finding that tiny amounts of sats were getting permanently stuck in these complex scripts. The previous higher dust limit was actually preventing the wallet from processing the necessary transactions to clear those logic paths.
I see.
So lowering it to 500 sats allows those specific complex transactions to unstick. It really highlights how different wallet architectures have to balance base layer rules against their own specific operational use cases.
Speaking of different architectures handling base layer realities, we also saw AQUA wallet navigating the Liquid Network hard fork this week without a hitch.
Oh yeah, ELEP 203.
Exactly. The ELEP 203 activation went live, and AQUA's infrastructure providers had already upgraded. ELEP 203 is a protocol upgrade on the Liquid sidechain that improves how transactions are processed.
The Liquid network is really crucial right now for moving volume off the main chain while retaining Bitcoin native properties.
Right.
And AQUA's real strength right now is how seamlessly they handle direct on-chain peg-ins. You send standard layer one Bitcoin to the wallet and it just effortlessly converts it to LBTC on the Liquid sidechain.
That's like magic for the user.
It is. It totally abstracts away the complexity of layer two accessibility, letting Liquid handle the fast, low fee transactions while the base layer remains the high friction, high security vault.
It makes the user experience completely seamless, which honestly brings us full circle to the core lesson of the week. Seamlessness is incredible for layer two routing and everyday spending.
Absolutely.
But on the base layer, when securing your sovereign wealth, friction is your friend.
The threat landscape has shifted dramatically toward human psychology. You cannot rely on being too smart to get scammed. The social engineering is just too good, and human panic is too primal.
It bypasses your logic.
It does. You must rely on physical, time-delayed protocols.
We have to embrace the friction of sovereign hardware. Don't complain about a backup twiz on your FrostSnap, or an air-gapped QR code transfer on your Keeper, or a 48-hour hold on Casa. That friction is the very mechanism keeping your wealth secure.
Well said.
And as we integrate AI agents to handle the complexity of Miniscript and decaying multisigs, we absolutely have to demand bounded authority. The AI drafts the plan, but your offline sovereign hardware executes the reality.
Which leaves us with a fascinating and honestly slightly unsettling thread to pull on.
Let's hear it.
We have spent this entire episode talking about building bounded authority to prevent AI from stealing our Bitcoin. We are keeping it in the sandbox, but the open source hardware we rely on, like the FrostSnap updates and the QoS microkernels, relies entirely on deterministic builds to mathematically prove the code hasn't been compromised.
To prove the strict parent hasn't been bribed.
Exactly. But as these code bases get larger and infinitely more complex, and as AI becomes deeply integrated into the development cycle itself, what happens in the near future when AI agents are the ones responsible for independently verifying the deterministic builds of our hardware firmware?
Oh, wow.
What happens when the AI is effectively acting as our automated security auditor, checking the math that protects the vault?
It's who audits the auditor.
Exactly. Who audits the auditor?
When the bank vault is mathematically impenetrable, the attacker hacks the human. But when we eventually hand the blueprints and the security audits over to an artificial intelligence who is hacking the AI, keep staying sharp, question your assumptions, and we will see you next week for another deep dive in the Bitcoin hole.
Hold your own keys, stay sovereign. Bitcoin hold, the Bitcoin hold.com.